I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, just coincidentally, a friend of mine told me she was awakened last night at 3 a.m. when her drunken neighbor was arrested by the police. Again. What do we do with these bad neighbors? Calling the police generally makes things worse. Talking to them sometimes helps, but only sometimes. These neighbors can keep us up at night, keep us ruminating during the day. They can cause anxiety, and we know from news reports they can cause rage. On today's show, we're going to take a look at how to deal with bad neighbors, what we're doing wrong, and what we can do better. My guests are Dan Simon, Bob Borzota, and Rue Landau. Simon is a mediator with Minnesota-based Twin Cities Mediation. He's a teacher and practitioner of a transformative mediation approach. He joins us by phone. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Dan. Glad to be here.
Bob Borzota is the author of Neighbors from Hell, and you can just guess about what that book's about. He also maintains a message board called Neighbor Solutions, and he's here in our studio. Bob, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
And Rue Landau, she's the executive director of the Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations, and she also schlepped out to join us in the studio. Rue, thank you.
Thank you.
Dan, let's start with you. So what's your guess about what's at the core of neighbor conflict?
I believe that any sort of conflict, regardless of the subject or even the relationship between the people, has to do with the basic human need to be respected or just treated. We have certain expectations about how our fellow humans are going to treat us and how much they're going to kind of pay attention to our needs. And when it seems that they are disregarding us or even intentionally doing us harm, we don't like it. And whether it's noise or clutter on our lawn or actual harsh words from the neighbor, it's this thing that we just expect to be treated with a certain amount of respect.
So I want to ask all my guests to respond to that opening question. Bob Borzota, how about you?
Well, you know
what? What's at the core here?
I think what Dan said is right on, and it unfortunately is becoming an unreasonable expectation that your neighbors are going to be treating you with respect. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't even know their neighbors by name anymore. You know, all of our friends are connected to us by our devices. And, you're on the other side of the fence, don't know you, but, you know, I'm going to tweet this, you know, little message for all of my other friends to see.
Yeah, all of your other friends and beyond. Rue, what's your take?
I don't know. I think on some level it's a basic human need to be respected, but it's also people just want to live in peace and harmony. And I do think there's a great need out there for people who want to get to know their neighbors, who want to feel like they live in community. And, you know, we should work as much as we can towards making those kinds of communities happen.
You know, this business, and I'll come back to you, Dan. You know what? I forgot to give out the phone numbers. I would imagine some of our listeners may have had experience with bad neighbors. We get to chuckle here. Our number is 888-477-9499. Give us a call if you've had an experience with a bad neighbor. Maybe you've been called a bad neighbor. We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. This business of understanding others, and I'll toss this to you, Dan, is really on a continuum. You know, now I'm talking as a psychologist here. So on the one hand, I see people that just don't have that wiring. I mean, they're self-consumed and self-absorbed, and more that's happening. And on the other end of the continuum, people are so worried about what other people think that they dare not do or say anything lest they offend somebody. So, you know, we're all in a continuum, and I don't know if that is a reasonable expectation anymore.
Sure. Well, yes, there definitely are personality types, and to a certain extent, you're stuck with the person who lives next door to you, and they are how they are. But I also think, to a large extent, regardless of who they are, even if they are, full-on diagnosable as having antisocial personality disorder, even those folks are harder to deal with if they feel threatened or insulted by you. So there's always some give in how they're going to interact. Mm. And so that's the part that we get to focus on as the good neighbor. How do we best manage this person, wherever they are on that continuum that you're talking about?
Spoken like a true mediator.
It is my job to be optimistic that people can get to a better place, yeah, regardless of who they are.
Yeah, I want to get to details about that in a minute. Rue, how do conflicts get to your office?
In the Human Relations Commission, first, we do two things. We enforce the anti-discrimination laws, the civil rights laws in the city, and we also have a community relations division that's out resolving conflicts and promoting intergroup harmony in communities every single day. We get cases that individuals will call us, but a lot of our cases are referrals from the police department, where we have in Philadelphia community relations officers in every police district, and we will get referrals from the community relations officers, from the district attorney's offices, social service agencies, a lot of politicians, and often the informal or formal structures of a neighborhood as well, the block captains, the community development corporations. Everybody the conflict will come to them and they want to resolve it, and then they refer it to our office.
Tell us about 311. Do they come to you through 311?
Sure, a lot of cases will now come to us through 311.
Tell us about that, and is it effective? Is it widely known? Do you know?
Yeah, I think it is widely known in Philadelphia, and it's probably streamlined how we get a lot of our referrals. It's a system in many cities and towns throughout the country now where it's all non-emergency informational requests that want to go through the city. They have this phone number, 311. You call, centralized operators will then listen to your concern, listen to your issue, and decide where you should go next. And there we get a lot of referrals from 311.
Bob, you come to this issue of bad neighbors, not because you woke up one day and thought it would be an interesting career choice.
Nope.
So tell us.
Well, I had my own bad neighbor, and it was right here in Philadelphia. And this was back in the 90s, before there was a book out, before there was a whole lot on the internet about how do you deal with these situations. And it can be really tough. And I think if my book is about nothing else, it's about how badly I handled my own neighbor situation. So it's a sort of a preaching of don't do this, but do this. And it took a long time to figure that all out. It's very tough. I think the toughest thing about it is that you're dealing with conflict close to home. It's a little different from conflict, like out on the road with road rage, stuff in the office. This is stuff that is with you, right next door or upstairs, downstairs, across the hall, whatever, 24/7. And when you're not at home, it is still with you. As you said, you're ruminating.
Ruminate, right.
Yeah, yeah. And what Rue was saying about 311, that is one of the most fabulous things that any municipality can put into place, and that is a one-stop shop for people who are looking for help, because you don't know whether, is this a zoning issue, or is it animal control, is it police? Call 311. It gets handled. You get the kind of guidance that you need. And one thing that Dan said that really struck me, he was talking about personality types. And you hear of type A personality, type B. I call this type NFH personality. There are people who are just born to be bad neighbors.
Neighbors from hell.
Neighbors from hell.
Yeah. Bob, a Census Bureau report about 10 years ago indicated that noise was the number one complaint people had about their neighbors, the number one reason people wanted to move. And, of course, one person's music is another person's noise. Your normal might make me crazy.
Right.
So
all of my surveys say the same thing. Noise always comes up as number one, followed generally by harassment, and harassment results when you complain to a neighbor about noise and they take it personally. And one of the chapters that I wrote in the book about noise is that it's in the ear of the beholder, as you just said. And it's not only that, maybe I don't like certain types of music that I'm hearing from my neighbor. How's this? I do like the same music as my neighbor. I want to play my music and hear it only in my home. And you play yours and, you hear it in your home. We don't have to share all of our enjoyment.
Yeah, I'd love my neighbor's music, but I don't love it at 11:30, 12 o'clock at night.
Yeah,
and the
you're trying to sleep.
Right, yeah. Right. So, Rue, how do we fix this?
How do we fix this? Well, first...
Well, how do you fix this? It's not a we.
It's all on you, Rue.
Exactly. Well, and I'm single-handedly doing it. No, we have a great team of my community relations staff that's on the ground. They're all split up by police districts and resolving conflicts every day. There's no doubt most of the cases that come to our office are all surround quality of life issues. It's noise. It's trash. It's dog feces. It's parking. Those are the big ones. The bouncing basketballs, which actually are noise. And we respond to every case. We give it each case, we give it as much attention as possible because it does two things for us. One, it gets us into a neighborhood. Getting to know these two individuals and helping to try to resolve these conflicts will get us to know a new neighborhood, maybe a new block, maybe help organize the block. We have a block captain system here in Philadelphia. If this particular block isn't organized and doesn't have a block captain, it might be a great idea to get it started here. The second one is we want to avoid a larger issue, too. We've had cases where this are getting into a small issue or a small dispute, probably made sure that there wasn't more violence. And that's a complicated sentence to say because you can't quantify the absence of violence. But in Philadelphia and in around the country, we've had cases where dog feces have led to shooting and death.
Mm-hmm.
If I can give an example also of a case where we, a prevention case where we believe we got in on, unfortunately, the end of it, but believe that we... created an environment that didn't cause more violence.
Yeah, I want to hear the story, and I want to hear how you did that.
Sure. This particular story is there was an off-duty police officer who shot and killed a young man in the neighborhood. And his friends, the youth, all were rallying around the off-duty officer's house at all times, like wanting an answer and wanting some sort of justice. Working with the parents, unfortunately, of the victim of the crime and the family, and also working with the police department and the DA's office, we got them to sit down together. We got the police captain to sit down and the DA to sit down with the family and talk it out and recognize that what we don't want from this moment on is more violence. And from that point on, the parents actually helped with the neighborhood to quell the tension that was happening and didn't create more violence.
And because of their tragedy, they become empowered.
Yes. The tactics we use, it depends. It's a case-by-case basis. I mean, sometimes what resolves an issue ends up being informal, what we call informal mediation, where it's you talk to one side, you talk to another side, you go back and forth a little bit, and they agree to resolve their differences. Sometimes there are formal mediations where we sit parties down. We have to spend a long time to get to the root cause of what the problem is because it's not always what
it's
they call us about.
It's not just feces.
Oh, no, it's something else. And it's something often that a long time back in history, actually, where one side seemingly disrespected or crossed the other. And a third one is, we have to remember with mediation, it only works when both parties want to participate. And if we have one side that doesn't want to participate in the mediation, we often will just kind of give the complaining party the tools they need to try to resolve the conflict, whether it's the phone numbers and contact people over at license and inspection, zoning, the streets department, animal control, any of those things that could help resolve the conflict, and that's the best we can do. It's unfortunate, and we often get called back to those cases about a year later.
I want to hear more about what mediation is and isn't, but let's get a caller first. We've got Barb on the line. Hi, Barb. Barb, do we have you?
Yes.
What can we do for you? You have a bad neighbor issue?
Well, yeah. Here's the situation. We have a sweet little lane in the burbs. All of our neighbors get along. I have an annual party for our eldest neighbor who's coming up on 89. There's one set of neighbors, and of course they're directly across the street, and at any one time they have 4 to 6 dogs. I've tried to, you know, tune out the barking issues, which there are barking issues when you have 4 to 6 dogs who are outside primarily. But years ago, I was walking our dog on a leash in a field near here, and there, at the time, 5 dogs attacked my dog. It was not pretty. My dog did not come out well. And the woman of the couple came over and said, "We're happy to pay for half of the vet bill, but we are not assuming any responsibility or liability." I should tell you, the husband is a lawyer.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Let me ask you.
At that point, we said we don't want the money, you know, because you were responsible. And we haven't talked to them since. And it's just very awkward not talking. I would like to make amends. My husband wants nothing to do with them. And I just feel, yeah, that's the crux. And I just feel like it's very awkward passing them.
Well, let's hear what our experts have to say about that. Thanks so much for your call. So I don't know, and you know, I'm going to turn to you first, Dan. What do you do when there's dogs? I mean, you can't say, you know, get rid of at least most of your dogs. I mean,
right.
What do you do?
Right.
How do you mediate something?
You can't pull the dogs into mediation either.
Right, they don't respond so well.
We've tried.
I, you know, for me, the good news about my role is that I never have to know what the outcome is going to be. For me, just the possibility of a conversation between Barb and the neighbors, assuming that doesn't anger her husband too much, that she wants to go ahead and have that conversation. Sounds like that's another question for Barb. But the conversation between Barb and the neighbors, you know, I don't know what creative solution could come up about the dogs being kept in the backyard, or you know, it sounds like one thing that would help if it happened to be feasible would be a real apology for what happened to Barb's dog a few years back, or whenever that was.
I don't see that happening.
No? How do you know?
Well, that's true. That's true.
It was years ago, though. I mean, they didn't feel compelled to apologize then. I don't think they're going to feel compelled to apologize
now. I disagree on that, too.
You know what I
learned when I was in Israel years ago, and there's a group of Israelis and Palestinians kind of working together, trying to figure out what they can do. And the one thing they know is they have to listen to each other's narrative and kind of respect it as truth. We have to listen to each other's narrative. So, Rue, why don't you jump in here?
Yeah, I agree. I've also done work with Israeli and Palestinian women, too, and various other factions in other countries. And they do understand that you do have to listen and understand. You don't have to agree. You just have to listen. I agree with Dan. I think that this is a good start, that Barb would want to speak to the neighbors. And I'm not convinced that after so many years, if there's a solution that could be as simple as an apology, which often comes up in our cases as well, that the neighbors who might be missing of community and neighborliness with Barb and her husband as well, might not just say, "We apologize."
That's back to the respect thing that Dan brought up at the top of the show.
Can I just jump in quickly on why I think that's especially possible in this case? It's that, you know, given that the husband across the street there is a lawyer, God bless him, and I'm licensed as a lawyer myself, we tend to be thinking kind of worst-case scenario about what would happen if we admitted responsibility and how will that be used against us. So a good conversation between Barb and the neighbors at this point, in which perhaps she assures them that, look, I'm not going to report you to animal control, but will you just look me in the eye and tell me you understand that it was your dogs that hurt my dog, or whatever Barb wants to hear exactly. To me, there's, you know, and in fact, the fact that time has passed, in fact, may have softened up the neighbors.
Yeah, we're going to take a, we got to take a short break and come back to this. But I always tell my patients that the last time you want to have a good conversation is when you're right in the middle of the conflict. You got to wait until the dust settles and it's not right in front of your face. We're talking about, well, I was going to say bad neighbors, but we're talking about neighbor conflicts, and we're going to expand it now to neighborhood conflicts when we come back from our break. I'm with Rue Landau, Executive Director of the Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations, Bob Borzata, author of Neighbors from Hell. Dan Simon is a mediator and a teacher and practitioner of the transformative approach that we want to hear more about after our break. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you if you have a bad neighbor, had a bad neighbor and resolved it, or didn't resolve it, or if someone has called you a bad neighbor. Moreover, I want to know if having a bad neighbor has turned you into a bad neighbor, turned you into somebody that you don't particularly like. 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Do you feel the need to check and recheck constantly? Are you a prisoner of certain rituals and compulsions? Keystone Clinical Studies in Norristown is conducting a research study of an investigational medication for treating obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. If you're between 18 and 65 and have been diagnosed with OCD, you may be eligible to participate. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or keystoneclinicalstudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about neighbor conflicts and neighborhood conflicts with guests Dan Simon, Bob Borzata, and Rue Landau. I want to talk about this transformative mediation approach. Dan, will you elaborate on that a little bit? What is it?
I would be happy to, and in fact, I want to give proper respect to a Philadelphian who wrote the book on transformative mediation. Joe Folger, who's a professor at Temple, was one of the co-authors of the book that defined this approach. And the approach, to people who aren't lawyers, seems kind of like common sense. I think part of what the transformative model has done is help us start fresh with defining what conflict is. And as we see it in this model, conflict is kind of, as I said earlier, it is about the interaction between the people. And we all, as I said, you know, we like to be respected. We also like our autonomy. And if we feel like our interaction with somebody is you know, someone's trying to control us, or they just aren't understanding us, we don't like that. The good news is the fact that we don't like that gives us, and usually the other person, some incentive to get to a better place. And kind of the assumption is that people are happiest when they feel both in control of themselves and like they're interacting with the other people around them in a constructive, positive way. We kind of all would rather be generous and kind and empathic in general. And so part of what we hate about these neighbors from hell, or the people we're experiencing that way, is that, you know, I'm actually a nice guy. I would like to be the kind of guy who, you know, invites my neighbors over, but this person is not letting me be that nice guy I want to be, so it's really frustrating. So transformative mediation basically allows people to have the kind of conversation that gets them back to that preferred state of both kind of good care of oneself and good care of the other. And it differs a bit from the other mediation approaches out there that have focused more on the outcome and kind of trying to get people to some kind of agreement. Sometimes those agreements can come at the expense of people actually feeling better about their interaction with each other. So you can have a deal, but both people are still resentful about it, and the conflict manifests itself in other ways.
I wonder about the issue of objectivity, and I'm going to turn to you, Ro, because you do mediation. Do we always have to be completely objective? Aren't there cases where one person is wrong?
Well, if you want to have a successful mediation, it's important to stay as objective as possible. You really, you are the third party neutral in the dispute, and it's important to not force the parties in either direction to get them towards the what you think would be the proper outcome or goal. They have to be the ones who are driving the result. If not, they won't have any ownership in it. So, in the end of the day, you are probably not their neighbors, right? They have to live with each other. And if they're actually sitting at the table and trying to resolve their differences to get to a place of peace, it is best that they do this on their terms, in their way. And it might not be the result that you think is best for them, but that's how they crafted it. And that's the one they'll actually, you know, sign their name on that one.
How are your mediators trained, Ru?
We go through a program in Philadelphia, a Good Shepherd mediation program, and make sure that they have at the minimum of the basic mediation training. It's actually a 24-hour training. It goes through 3 days. And then take various courses and levels, because there's differences when you're doing group mediations or three parties at a time. There's different skills and different tactics you need for those.
And Dan, just quickly, what kind of training do you need for transformative mediation?
It is possible to become a certified transformative mediator, which involves basically demonstrating your competence by having a videotape of yourself mediating or doing a simulated mediation, and then talking through it with one of the old school experts. And if you appear competent, then you can become certified. We also have kind of, sounds like similar to what Ru is talking about, some basic trainings of 24 to 40 hours that are kind of the minimal credential.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Joan on the line. Hey, Joan.
Hi.
Hi. So what can we do for you?
Well, I live in a attached house, an old attached house, and my neighbor, unbeknownst to me, just stopped talking to my husband and I, and we have no reason why. We couldn't understand it. No argument, no specific thing. And then I had struggled with it for many years because it's not very peaceful, or it's a lot of stress living next to someone like that and not speaking. She was getting sick. I approached her. She's dying, she said. And she reached out to me and responded to my approach, cried in my arms, and now we're speaking. So yeah. It took her to be dying for us to somehow reconnect.
That's a wonderful story, Joan, and I thank you for it. It's also an instructive story, and I thank you for sharing that with us, Ru.
I think that's actually a really important point that you just made, Joan. I'm so glad that you have reconnected, that you did reconnect with your neighbor. But I wanted to say that it's an important lesson for us to know that we never know what's going on in our neighbor's lives, and that's important. And we can have, you know, as Bob's saying, the evil neighbor who's never going to be at peace with anybody, but you also have a lot of people who are going through their own family turmoil and might be more internal and might not be one to reach out. And you should respect that and also know that you might not know what you're walking into, and to give a little space for that.
Bob, you raised some tips in your resolving neighbor conflicts.
Yes.
So what's number one?
Number one is to be a good neighbor yourself. And that is not always as simple as it may seem, because if you ask someone who is doing something wrong in their neighborhood, they say, well, I'm a good neighbor. People are just not, you know, self-reflective enough to say, oh, well, maybe I shouldn't have my dog out barking at 2 a.m. And they think, well, it's not bothering me. Why should it bother anyone else? And, you know, it's my gosh darn house. No one's going to tell me what I'm going to do in my house. And, you know, people do, as Rue was saying, people are going through their own things. And then people also have their own unique takes on what it is to be a neighbor. And they very often people think, oh, well, you know, this person's wonderful, doesn't complain about my noise or anything. But I say, well, you know, what about, you know, that person doesn't make noise. That makes a good neighbor, too.
Our social structures, and I want to continue with you, Bob, here, mm-hmm. have been deteriorating for a couple of decades now, if not more.
Yeah.
Do you think this contributes to increased frequency or intensity of neighbor conflict?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, people are not taught in school how to treat their neighbors in many cases. I think you're seeing, you know, a little more progressive approaches in schools now, treating others with respect, and that would carry over into neighbors. But there's that, plus it is a much higher pressurized world that we're all living in. We're spending more time at work. We have all these devices going off at all times. So, you know, we do have our own stress all the time, and that is going to spill over sometimes with the neighbors.
Well, I just raised something, and I'm not so sure it's true, and I'll turn to you, Rue. Are conflicts between neighbors, are they increasing in frequency and intensity?
It depends on how you look at it. I would agree. Certainly, relations between neighbors are different now. It's to the extent that everybody used to know each other on a block and in a neighborhood. That's not necessarily true. But I do think also the pendulum swung really far to the other side, and everybody was very internal. And I do think we're taking steps to get out of that, whether it's an issue politics of a particular neighborhood that everyone is rallying around to fix the school, to get the big pothole fixed on the block. I do think that there are ways in which we're creeping out and know that we went too far in the other direction, and that we do have to connect and reach out to each other. I would say, you know, for us, it depends, you know, whether it's the success of 311 or the success of our work that gets passed on to other people. Certainly right now we have more conflicts coming in our office than we did last year. But I also say that I think the economic downturn and the recession has a tremendous effect on what's happening here. People are very, they're unemployed. They're upset about it. They're at home. They're struggling. Everyone's struggling. And I do think that that struggle has caused conflict. And it has also caused this next step of what I'm talking about, of people reaching out and being more neighborly with each other and maybe possibly, I hope, on the road to recovery.
And it turns things from I to we.
Yes.
You know, it's funny. Speaking of I to we, you know, I've been reading about these threats from Al-Qaeda and how, you know, we had to shut down embassies over the world, around the world. And all of a sudden, I'm hearing Democrats and Republicans agreeing with something. So, it, you know, that external threat turns it from I to we. And, you know, it's a shame that we need that kind of external threat sometimes. Let's go back to the phone. We've got Elliot on the line. Hi, Elliot.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just have a question. I had a business moved in, supposedly a restaurant, but it acted more like a bar. They had no alcoholic license, but like almost every weekend. This has been going on for a long time, and I called the city, and it just seemed like the city didn't care. Now, they are making, I presume the city is making money off this business, but when it comes to a neighborhood such as this property, the low-income neighborhood, it just seemed like they didn't care. It is a business, and a lot of the neighbors were afraid to call because they fear that somebody would know it was them that called, and they fear retaliation. How do you deal with something like that?
Well,
and I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay, we happen to have just the right panel of guests. You called the right number, Elliot. So, Elliot's first complaint was about the city, so that,
that's me.
Guess who gets that one?
That's we deal with the businesses all the time, and we have they come to us as two different types. One, neighbors that are upset, either the fear of having the business on the corner to begin with and or the actions of the business. And we also have another instance that I'll talk to you about of just change, right? So businesses have certain standards in every city and every town, and there's rules and ways in which they need to be govern themselves. And it's usually hours of operation and certainly noise, and there can't be any illegal activity coming out of them. In Philadelphia, for example, we have the Public Nuisance Task Force that's part of our district attorney's office, that if there's a corner store that starts to turn into basically a bar, that they'll go in and they'll do something about
that. So it's 311 that gets us to that.
It is 311 that would get us to that. Or if you need, you know, a direct call to the DA's office, if you didn't know of 311. And what we're trying to push through the Commission on Human Relations is also really, whether it's the small corner store or the large housing complex, that these businesses need to have a social investment as well as a business investment. They're moving into a neighborhood. They need to be a part of the community. They have to be welcoming. People should say hi and good morning to the neighbors. They should sweep outside of the place. If, for example, you're a business with means and the neighborhood doesn't have streetlights, let's work on getting some streetlights. Let's put a playground in down the street, down the corner. Those are the things that I think are important. That makes you a part of the fabric of the community. And if you don't take those steps and you don't get to know people and you do break the city's laws, then certainly there should be consequences for that.
When we've got to take another break. When we come back, I want to talk about group conflicts in communities and even schools. I mean, bullying is a way of a group conflict. So I want to talk about the larger picture too, and the psychology of neighborhoods. And I know both of you have, all of you have addressed that directly and indirectly. We're talking about neighbor conflicts and soon neighborhood conflicts with Dan Simon, a mediator, and he teaches the transformative approach through the Institute of the Study of Conflict Transformation. Bob Borzota is author of Neighbors from Hell. He's got a message board called Neighbor Solutions. Rue Landau is executive director of the Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations. Our number, we've got a couple of lines open. We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY-FM.
1 in 3 families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at IamConcerned.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about neighbor conflicts and neighborhood conflicts. Rue, whether it's a whatever kind of neighborhood, each neighbor does have its own culture, its own personality. Is it possible to change a community psychology?
It is possible. It also happens at times as a kind of the force and the longtime members of the community aren't very happy with it. There's a lot of changing neighborhoods in Philadelphia as well as around the country, whether it's an influx of a new immigrant group or refugees, or whether it's the change of people's races, religions, and then the community norms sometimes change. But for us, what we've always seen is that so long as you do, as we've been talking about, get to know your neighbors, treat everybody with respect, recognize and respect difference, neighborhood can live in harmony.
I want to talk to you, Bob, about community psychology and neighbor psychology.
Parapsychology.
Yeah, you did you say para or power?
Oh, para. Para, yeah.
Do you have experience in your work as a reporter or researching for the book about communities with a mentality?
Not that specifically. I was a reporter with the Inquirer and Associated Press, you know, two decades ago. My work really hasn't covered community-wide conflict. It's always been neighbor versus neighbor, one-on-one.
I wonder about you, Dan Simon. Do you mediate larger groups?
I've worked with communities of up to 12 participants, so that's about it. No, I haven't gotten involved in a whole neighborhood-type situation.
I wonder about the mentality. You've got a program, Ruin Schools, where you intervene in schools. I mean, they're neighbors there, too, in schools, and we've got bullying in schools, and that's a group conflict right there. So yeah. What kind of interventions do you have for that? And by the way, bullying is something that that Bob, you know, called, adults who bully is bad neighbors, you know?
We will respond to any request for conflict resolution, and we often are thankfully called in before things really explode and blow up. That's the best time to get into a conflict, if things are still brewing and you have an opportunity to make peace there instead of afterwards is fantastic. We've been involved with the schools a lot, and in Philadelphia there was a particularly bad incident that happened at one high school with that was violence against Asian immigrant youth. And we took that opportunity in 2011 to do a district-wide approach and survey and research into what do we need to do in every school in order to make district-wide solutions to what were district-wide problems. And some of them were very simple, and some of them were complicated. Simple of really listening to listening to the students, letting them have a voice, making sure that the rules are applied to everyone in a uniform manner. More complicated ones, which just simply because it comes to funding, is to institute programs of peer mediation. That's not very costly, and go as far as restorative practices, which is an incredibly important healing program for especially schools, but works in every community. And that is when you take a victim and an offender and you actually sit them down to talk to each other, and they can talk about the pain that occurred because someone was victimized, and the offender then has to face the victim and also explain why the offender did it. It's a great program for many schools, and thankfully is getting instituted in more Philadelphia schools. But between that and language access and various other programs, I mean, it's a complicated system, the schools, especially because the city's constantly changing. But we think we put down some recommendations to help. Anyway, on our website, www.phila.gov/human-relations, you can get to our report, is widening the circle of our concern, public perceptions.
And I'm sure you're well aware that the Southern Poverty Law Center has some excellent, excellent programs for teaching tolerance in schools at every level. Let's go to the phones. We've got Michaela on the line. Hey, Michaela.
Can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Yes, hi. My question is about mental health issues. There's a neighbor in our neighborhood who is clearly suffering from some mental health issues, but has also been organized enough to really terrorize the neighborhood for many years. And other than going through the police, you know, I'm wondering if there are any social service outlets that can be of help. And I'll be happy to take my answer off the air.
I'll take that one. Those are hard. We get them a lot. There are definitely, you know, there are definitely situations in neighborhoods where the person who's causing the issue has mental health problems. If the person doesn't want to get help and it's not to the point where they're at harm, risk of harm to themselves or others, you are in a very difficult position as to what to do next. You can try to get them connected to social services. I'm a legal services lawyer by trade. I always found that telling my clients that they should go talk to someone because they seem stressed out versus pointing out the mental health issue certainly helped. You should talk to someone just to relieve the stress, and that would get them in the system. Certainly if they're older, sometimes there's aging programs in your community that can come out just to make sure.
Such as, how would we find that, aging programs in the community?
There's plenty of simple Google search, I think, but, you know, for us in Philadelphia, there's Philadelphia Corporation of the Aging and other programs. But if you go to them, they'll at least take a step out, check out the family, see if they need some food and get started from
the
there.
The city also has an excellent Office of Behavioral Health with Dr. Evans runs that. I wonder if they have resources that could reach out to someone in the community and or the neighbors.
We do, and there's more mobile attempts to get out into communities. But again, to keep someone connected, I think sometimes calling it something different from therapy is what helps. And also, just if it's seen as support instead of any sort of attempt to fix them is really what's been helpful in the past. But it can be concerning. It really can, and it can disrupt a block in a neighborhood very, very easily.
I want to talk about expense here. I have a feeling that your service is free.
Yes.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you, Dan. What does it cost for neighbors to resolve this through your approach? I assume this is all privately funded.
My practice is, but we have community mediation centers here in Minneapolis and St. Paul as well, so if cost is a concern, those are probably the first place to turn. You know, I generally get involved in cases that have already escalated to the point of litigation, and so people are already used to writing big checks to their lawyers, so, you know, they pay me by the hour at, I charge $295 an hour for most cases.
Wow. Really? So where do I have to go to get trained in this?
Well, I didn't say I'm booked solid at that rate, by the way.
In Philadelphia, Good Shepherd Mediation Program has a set cost, but I think when they know they're coming into any sort of a emergency situation in which they can make great change in the city, they will reduce their rates as needed.
Bob, I've got to tell you, changing, going in a different direction.
You don't want to talk about the fact that my book is only $15 as
and,
opposed to...
And we'll resolve the problem. Nice job. Yes. Nice plug. You worked that in beautifully. Yeah. So I was surprised to hear that you felt the ground zero for neighborhood disputes was in suburbia.
Yes.
And actually our first caller today was in the suburbs.
Yeah. And, you know, I've lived in the suburbs. I've lived in the sticks, basically. And I've lived right here in Philadelphia. You can have these conflicts anywhere. But somehow the suburban landscape just lends itself now to conflict when it comes to, you know, having a junk car in your yard. Well, you're not going to have that complaint in the city. There are no yards. As far as noise goes, I had a noisy neighbor in the city, and that was on the other side of a party wall. In the case of a suburban community, very often they've been developed to have all these adjoining backyards so that you, when you have your, you know, DJ-enhanced backyard barbecue going till midnight or later every other weekend, you know, you're affecting a great number of people, and a great number of people are, you know, sometimes getting back at you by retaliating with their own noise. And so, suburbia is ground zero from my standpoint. You know, I'm not in the city right now, and I'm actually living in the suburbs right now. So, of course, I'm thinking, hell, you know, this is the worst it could ever be. But I do get more complaints myself by way of my website, from suburbanites.
Yeah, I would also think people move to the suburbs with a certain set of expectations.
Yes, unrealistic, and they wind up being unrealistic, unfortunately.
Aren't they all?
What, the expectation you're moving out of the city, it's going to be quieter?
Expectations always create problems. They always do, because either they're met and you ignore them, or they're not met, and and you're disappointed and resentful.
Well, they would probably serve themselves very well when looking to, move into a new home, wherever it is, to focus on the type of community, whether they belong in that type of community themselves. If, someone like me should not be in a high-rise that caters to college kids, because I have a wife and a kid and I work for a living.
Well, I want to stop you there, and we've only got a few seconds left, but not everybody has that option, Rue. You know, some people don't have choice about where they live. They have to live where they can afford or where they'll be accepted.
Right. So if I can leave you with one rule we said already earlier, and we'll say it again, live in your neighborhood, act as if you want to be treated. Honor thy neighbor and do your best to be the good neighbor yourself and model that behavior, and you will hopefully get that same kind of behavior in return.
So when you're living in a neighborhood, it's not just about you.
No.
If you're in a neighborhood, it's about your neighbors.
Model good neighbor behavior.
Yeah. Have some empathy.
Well, yes. Unfortunately, we are out of time for the show. We've got left a lot of callers on the line. I apologize for that. But it's been a great show, and I want to thank Dan Simon, Bob Borzata, and Rue Landau. I think you've been great. I appreciate your expertise.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Next week on Voices in the Family, memoir, what it is and why it's therapeutic and how. Well, we'd love your comments about today's show, or download this show or other shows. We're at voices.org/voices, and you can follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam, and I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luner is our executive producer of audio content. Anna DiStefano is our summer intern. This is her last day, and we say a tearful goodbye to Anna. Anna, you've been wonderful. How lucky we all are to have had you. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. And, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.